Simeon are talking about the third noble truth, the cessation, Nirodha-saccha. That the realization of cessation, and trying to point to the what that really means in an actual experience that you can do now, rather than thinking it's something that you must realize at some distant time. What I'm trying to do is take the Buddhist teachings and apply them to actual practical situations that we have to live with and be with. Because so much religious teaching is kept on a kind of theological level of intellectual kind of speculation or just blind believing, but it doesn't apply to anything real in our lives. We're just living our daily lives. What are we supposed to do? The Four Noble Truths, do they have any practical value for our lives, or are they just some kind of high-minded philosophical teaching? Now, when I'm pointing to the way to contemplate the Four Noble Truths is by looking at yourself, seeing dukkha, seeing the suffering that one has, seeing the arising of it, according to the grasping of desire, identifying with the desires of the instinctual nature of the body, of the emotions and of the ideas, the intellectual ability, by identifying with all that, then of course is this sense of suffering. Because all these things, these three kinds of desires are unsatisfying. They're moving, changing conditions, and any attachment to them will only take us to some form of doubt or despair or death. Our identity out of ignorance is with mortality. Like I was saying last night, we are identified with what dies. Pretty depressing, isn't it? Think of it like that, because there's a great attempt to cover this over in our society. In modern European world, we don't talk about things like this. We talk about how to fulfill yourself, how to get what you want, how to fulfill all your desires. Then we wonder why, when we do get everything we want, why we still have this feeling of discontentment. At least I have. I have everything I want. Why do I still feel discontented? Getting more, wanting more and getting more, I knew that wouldn't be the answer. Also fear, with a lot of fear about ourselves, the instinctual nature and the mystery of the universe and all this. We don't know what it is that drives us, and we can see that in our just the instinctual nature of our bodies has a certain kind of force in it that sometimes is rather frightening, kind of almost reptilian, animal kind of energy. Yet when you see contemplate the human brain, the actual cortex of the brain is the same as a reptile's. And it's an evolution, isn't it? And so we share, say, that kind of karma. And you notice the kind of brutal side of mankind is usually represented in kind of reptilian fashions. So that the kind of National Front, or these kind of organizations that think on a very low level, usually take on kind of reptilian appearance, leather and spikes and barbed wire, isn't it? It's all brutal, whips and things that are harsh, coarse, brutal, or like the hide of a dinosaur, or cold-blooded, isn't it? Just like you think of this cold-blooded reptilian mind that could take something like a baby, or I mean, just cut its head off without feeling the slightest sense of doubt or emotion about it. It's like a crocodile could just gobble down a human baby without the sweetest, most darling baby. So there's that brutal side. When we sink into just instinctual instinct alone, we can sink to a very low level, a kind of demonic behavior, cold-blooded, hard-hearted, totally out of touch with the emotions, or with the heart, with the ideals, with the intellect. So that can be rather frightening. And it's also exciting, isn't it? Like all that kind of brutality has a certain excitement to it, certain attractive quality. Really, people being attracted to it, to speeding around in motorcycles with leather gear on and all kinds of knives and weapons. It's kind of tough and kind of glamorous in a way to be cold-hearted, unfeeling and brutal and strong and powerful. The emotional plane is also, can also be frightening, because this isn't the emotional plane of our lives is something that isn't so stable and dependable. Like with ideas, you can hold on to ideas and you can hold them in your mind, like the idea of being good and or democracy or freedom and equality, liberty, equality, fraternity, the cry of the French Revolution, very high-minded ideal. And you can hold it, you can keep it from now, next in the morning you can think liberty, equality, fraternity, next year liberty, equality, fraternity. 50 years from now, liberty, equality. But the emotions are very changeable. So sometimes you feel inspired or depressed or whatever. You can feel attraction or aversion. The emotions are like they're picking up the way things are in the present. So they're not kind of ideals that you can. Hold on to in a continuous way. The emotional nature is feeling what's happening. The pleasure, the pain, the good fortune, the bad fortune, the praise and the blame. Ideally, you can say, it doesn't matter to me whether people praise me or criticize me. I'm not at all interested in happiness or suffering. I want to transcend it all and realize the true Dhamma, Nibbana, free from all suffering. That's an ideal. But then when somebody criticizes you, you go, cry. Somebody praises you, you jump for joy. You inherit £1 million and you jump for joy, you lose it and you want to kill yourself. But all the while, there's that rational thing that says, well, I should really not really mind all this. Losing £1 million shouldn't really bother me in the least. But then the emotions are what? Depression, despair at having lost something. So there's this conflict, isn't there, on these different levels of ideas of how it all should be, how you should be, which may be very different, which an ideal, remember, doesn't have a flesh and blood body. It's an idea. Is the ideal man or ideal woman doesn't have blood and nerve endings and hearts and livers and all that. An ideal woman is a concept in the mind, and it is not affected by the forces of nature. It remains a constant kind of perception. It's an idea. It's celestial. It's refined, but we have to deal with things like the instinctual nature of an animal's body, with the emotions, with the feelings, the sensitivity, being open and vulnerable to all kinds of things in just daily life, just the things that can affect us. You contemplate your existence, is that we're all very vulnerable creatures thrown out into a universe that can be very dangerous, which we don't really understand, which is mysterious. And we pick up things. We've got eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. We've got a brain. We think. We've got emotions. We feel. We've got a heart. All this is sensory. It's sensitive. And so it always presents us with some kind of pain. The sensitivity is painful, isn't it? In other words, not painful in the sense of hurting, but it's a sense of an agitation. It's a sense of there's something always irritating, agitating, going on in the sensory realm. And if we're not aware of the way it is, then we just tend to react to it, either running away, trying to hide, suppress, seek a safe place where nothing can hurt us and where we can protect ourselves. Like somebody like Howard Hughes was a good example of a crazy man that had everything, ended up hiding away from everyone, absolutely terrified of the world, living in total isolation. He's a man that had everything on the material world, power, fame, money, success, but was absolutely terrified because he did not understand any of the forces that were operating through him. So when you contemplate your existence, you realize that this is something we just have to accept, our vulnerability and sensitivity, and the irritation, frustration, and pain, suffering that comes from it is something we must bear with, something we must accept, even gladly accept with an open heart rather than grudgingly, just try to bear it, but embrace it. It's like embracing suffering. Rather than keep trying to push it away and deny it and hide from it, you open up to it, you embrace it. Because we are vulnerable, we make ourselves completely vulnerable rather than trying to find any way to get out of it. And so our religious nature can be fulfilled by this making ourselves vulnerable and embracing the suffering, the pain, the unknown, the mystery of this life that we're living. Now to be able to do that, then our life no longer need be an escape, but an opening to it all. Just this sense of being a vulnerable person, we begin to break through, the sense of being a person. The dangers we see are still present, but they're dangers, but the body and the conditions of mind are not self, not ours anyway, so that we don't make problems about them. When you begin to free yourself from that wrong view of oneself being these mortal conditions of body and the mortal conditions of mind, then there is a sense of courage and openness that we don't have when we are caught in the illusion that these are ours. Because when we identify with them, then they're constantly being threatened. I am being threatened But when they're not ours, then they're just what they are. And we needn't make a problem about them. We learn from them, we embrace them, we know them, we study them, we contemplate them, we let them go. We allow them to change according to their nature. We're no longer trying to manipulate, control, or exaggerate any of their qualities. Now this knowing is what? This ability to reflect and know, what is that? What do we mean by that? If we're not the five khandhas, if we're not the mortal conditions, then who are we? Who am I? Who is it, and what is it that knows all this? What is it that's reflecting on this? What is wise? Is it, who is wise? And what is, if there's the deathless, then what is that? What is deathlessness? What is immortality? Now the Buddhist approach is by contemplating mortality till you realize immortality. You can't realize immortality if you still are attached to being immortal, because then you're just trying to create an illusion that like the Jehovah's Witnesses, people like this do, that you're the Jehovah's Witnesses have this view of heaven, where when you die, if you've been a good Jehovah's Witness, you go up to paradise, or eventually, I think eventually the earth will become the paradise, where you come back and live on this earth in a totally happy state forever, with your own body, your own face, with all your friends who have been Jehovah's Witnesses. So the immortality becomes merely an idea an ideal of being happy and young forever. Healthy, happy, young, in a parkland where everything is beautiful forever. It's like a child's dream of paradise, isn't it, with the soda water fountain. Well, you can get an ice cream cone any time you want, or a piece of chocolate cake. Well, every wish fulfilling, you just wish, and there it is. You never have to wait for anything, and nobody says no, and everybody's pretty happy. So that the immortality is corrupted by holding on to an idea rather than realizing, knowing immortality. So we paint a picture of it and believe in that, but we don't really know it, do we? We aren't sure whether when we die, maybe, you know, none of us are Jehovah's Witnesses. What will happen to us? So in contemplating mortality, mortality is what? It's what's changing. It's what comes and goes. The body is a mortal thing. Emotions, instinctual drives, thoughts and ideas, all these are mortal. In other words, they arise and they cease, they begin and end. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, that refrain, the three characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not-self. Now, this journey, this spiritual journey, is one that is something that we have to realize within ourselves. It's not, you don't need to go to any place. It's not in India, not necessarily, or in England, but it's by realizing the mortality as not self, what's left? And then say there's the knowing, there's mental clarity, there's stillness, brightness. Now, when you contemplate, say, mortality, take something like a thought that you can, since you can't, you haven't seen, you can't remember when you were born, and your body won't die for a while yet, you have to work with things that are born and dying now, during this time, here in this room. Don't wait for your body to die, but do it now. Don't, I mean, don't die right now with your body, but... But watch, but learn from that which is born and dies in your mind. It all works on the same principle. So we, last evening I talked about cessation, the death of that which was born, or the end of that which began. Taking just the thought, I am, is a thought, isn't it? It arises and ceases. Just noting your breath, the inhalation, exhalation. Outside that breath, there's a knowing, isn't it? There's that which can observe the breath that is not the breath. So that when you're observing the breath, there's attentiveness, attention to something that is arising and ceasing, but is transcending that very breathing of the body. There's that which can hear the thoughts in your mind, that which can contemplate and reflect, I am a human being. The knowing, that which is knowing and alert, both to that which is born and dies and that space around it, where it arises and ceases. So in our intention now for right understanding is to be that which is alert and attentive and knowing. We call it being the knowing. We take the position of being the knowing rather than being someone who knows anything. As soon as you attach to it as a personal thing, then it becomes another form of delusion. So rather than considering yourself one who knows anything, be the knowing, be that which is alert, even to the thought that I am the one who knows something. Any form of I am or I am not, you can see as something that arises and ceases. Now in that state of attentiveness, you're really like you're watching, listening, you're being very alert, you're open. You're vulnerable now. You're not trying to hide. You're right out there, completely alert and attentive. Then just think, I am a mortal thought. It's a thought. And yet we can make the I ams of our life into a source of depression, isn't it? I'm no good. I wish I weren't here. I've made so many terrible mistakes. Nobody loves me. I'm a hopeless case. We can make all these I ams into, you get caught into it. And you're not mindful, isn't it? You're believing all this. I'm no good. I knew one person who used to have a constant kind of refrain in the back of his mind. I'm no good. For his whole life he's had that. He says it's always been that way ever since childhood, the sense of, I'm no good. In fact, he's very good actually, but it's just some kind of karmic habit he's developed. So then we think, well, I'm really good. You know, I'm kind, I'm good-hearted. And you try to convince yourself that you're all right. And you say, Venerable Samedo, am I all right? I say, yes, you're a really great, marvelous person. He's just saying that. say. Venerable Samhita, am I really... No, you're terrible. Horrible. So then you feel depressed or angry with me. Or you think, maybe he's right. He must know I'm a terrible person. See, even Ajahn Sumedho says that. That means that I must really be terrible. So the I ams, can be a source of I'm better than you. I'm purer. I'm a much finer kind of person, a kind of arrogant conceit. Or I can be the kind of idyllic egalitarian. We're all equal. You're the same as I am. I'm not better and I'm not worse. You're as good as me. I'm as good as you. We're all the same. We're all equal. That is less threatening, isn't it? But it's still, I am in it, and you. Now these are mortal things, aren't they? I am, and you are, and I should, and you should, and should not. These are what we call mortal conditions of mind. They're death-bound. When you attach to I am in any form, and believe it, and grasp that, it takes you to despair. So thinking about yourself will only take you to either to these foolish extremes. Either you build yourself up and try to convince yourself you're better than everybody, but then there's still, you're not really fooling yourself, because then you feel guilty. You know, you really can't get away with it. Or you can go around just disparaging yourself, thinking that's being honest. And I hear people say, I know the truth about myself, and I'm honest, I'm not going to deny, I'm no good. That's, being really honest about yourself, aren't you? Because somehow honesty implies that you admit to, you have to admit your faults. But if you say, well, I'm a kind person, I do a lot of good works, and I'm helpful and all that. In Britain, that sounds like you're boasting, doesn't it? In English people find that like you're boasting. So if you go around saying, well, I'm really a very kind person, and I love people, and I love to help people, it sounds like you're a real jerk. Silly goose. But if you kind of go around saying, I'm no good, hopeless case, I'm not good enough, I'm not clever enough, I'm not kind enough, I'm not loving enough, I'm not generous enough, I'm not clever enough, and all that, that's somehow being honest. So admitting one's faults is honesty, admitting one's virtues is boasting. But virtues or faults we're looking at now, but not anything that I am is involved in, that thought, now you're looking at it, deliberately looking at it. So you will be so clear about what that is. This is what reflection on that. So you just listen, you say it over and over, and you say it slowly, and you say it fast, and you say anything after it, I am good or I am bad, or anything you want, any adjective you want to add to I am, or I am not, or I should not. Where does it arise and where does it cease? Ask yourself. That mortal condition of mind, I am, where does it arise? So note that before you think it. It arises in the mind. You're looking at the mind now. The mind ground. You can hear, you can know the space, the emptiness, the mind where all these conditions arise and cease. Now, this is what we call an upaya, or skillful means. The skillful means in order to investigate something, so we have an insight into it. So we're not going just on the theory of cessation, or just thinking because we understand the theory of it that we've actually experienced it. We're now investigating mortality, that which is mortal, like one thought, deliberate thought, I am. Who is it that knows this? Who is it? What is it that watches? Can you get behind the watcher or the listener? Or is there just listening and watching? You can't find what it is that listens and watches and is attentive, can you? I can't. Investigate like this. I can't find that. I can't get behind that. I can only be that knowing, that which is attentive, that which listens and watches. Being alert, in other words. So like closing my eyes, just listening. I am. And sustain your attention on that, on the emptiness after am, or before I. Sustaining your attention on it, you will realize emptiness of mind. To sustain your attention on that, you keep alert, because as soon as you're thinking or lose the mindfulness or the attentiveness, of course you'll go into you'll be seeking something else. You'll be drifting off here or there. So you keep this attentiveness, so you begin to, you know this state of emptiness. You know emptiness, you know form. There's the knowing. There's the knowing of form and the knowing of emptiness. And the form arises and ceases in the emptiness. And emptiness isn't like nothingness. It's not like it's a blank oblivion. It's vibrant. It's clarity. It's not like nothing, kind of in a trance or off in a state of oblivion. But it's attentive. It's alert, knowing. And this is the way out of suffering, the Fourth Noble Truth. The insight into the magga, or the path, the Eightfold Path, which is the first step on the Eightfold Path, is right understanding. Seeing the understanding, samadhiti, or perfect understanding. An understanding that is no longer is beyond doubt. It's not theoretical understanding, intellectual understanding, or anything like that. It's right understanding. Self-knowledge, isn't it? You're learning from yourself the truth. Now, in practice, you need to keep doing this over and over to make this emptiness something that you really know, and not just a momentary flash of insight, but keep working at it, so that the actual alertness of mind with nothing there, no thought, is what is your kind of sign for your practice. Or the doubt, who am I, or that emptiness of mind where the thinking process stops. And there's a hesitant, there's a gap, there's space, there's alertness, there's clarity. But that's not the end of it. That's not the goal, is to realize emptiness, but to realize truth. So the realization of truth is the insight into all conditions, sabbe sankhara anicca, all conditioned phenomena is impermanent. All the forms, the things that arise and cease in your mind are impermanent. The body is impermanent. The universe, the material universe that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch is impermanent. All dhamma, as a sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhamma is not self. And in that statement, anatta, this word anatta. So all dhamma, the conditioned, the unconditioned, the mortal, the immortal, is not self. So that the five khandhas are not self. Rupang anatta, vedana anatta, sanya anatta, sankara anatta, vinyanang anatta. We say sape sankara anicca, all conditioned phenomena is impermanent. Sape tama anatta, all dhamma is not self. Now some people misinterpret this as saying there's no soul, there's no God, all dhamma is totally nothing. There's no self. In it. And this of course is from theorizing without practicing. It sounds maybe like nihilism, doesn't it? Like annihilationism. There's no soul, no God, nothing. It's all, Dhamma is nothing. There's no self in it, and it's impermanent. Well, Dhamma is, there's permanent and impermanent. Now Dhamma includes everything from the condition, unconditioned, form, and emptiness, nibbana. Now the last realization, enlightenment, has to be solely up to you, which is from this point, sape sankhara anicca, sape tama anatta, is what is up to you. In other words, your insight into the truth, which is nameless, has no name. We just use the word dhamma as a expedient means only. So it's a completely, it has to be you that is enlightened, or this being here. And who is that? What is it that gets enlightened? And that, and so you can't get behind that. You can't say the truth is nothing, or that it's just emptiness, or there's nothing to say about it. It's beyond. It's a transcendent. And the teachings of Buddha are just merely expedient means, expedient methods only. To contemplate, to help us reflect, and to guide us towards that ultimate realization. So that's why the spiritual journey is a lonely one, in the fact that suddenly you're really thrown back on yourself, and on a sense of, and that sense of self you have to let go of and be alert, and through just that alertness of mind is developing what we call the magga, or the path. There's nothing more to it than that. And as you're alert and you sustain that alertness, and you listen and watch and you reflect, you use your ability to reflect, the Eightfold Path becomes clear. The right understanding, right thought, using our ability to think and reflect skillfully, then the right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, sama samadhi. Now, don't think of the Eightfold Path as steps that you take one at a time, but it's merely a teaching for reflection from the position of living as a human being in a society with right action, right speech, right livelihood, the emotional, the balance of right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, and the wisdom of right understanding, right intention, right thought, that kind of thing. Now this, as you say, contemplate this magga, or this path, what I've seen, my insight into it, is that once you live in a way that you don't feel ashamed of, and you have no regrets about, and no guilt or no doubts about, because if you aren't, then you're going to have too many kind of unpleasant emotional problems. So you have to be careful about what you do, what you say, because it all comes up into consciousness. Especially this path, everything is exposed in consciousness. There's no, you don't hide anything anymore. There's no way you can get away from anything. So that you realize you have to, because of that, because you're completely vulnerable now, and there's no defenses, there's no attempt to hide or get away or get out of anything whatsoever, because of that complete willingness to be vulnerable and open to everything, then of course we realize we have to be careful about what we do and say. If we are, then we're constantly hurting ourselves when we're doing things or saying things that are unkind or cruel. Mean or whatever, the immediate result, you get the immediate result of that, because you're now open, where before you might have been able to get away with a lot for a while because of your ability to go on to something else. So you tell a lie and you go on to something else, so you don't have to think about it. You even forget you told a lie. You can go on and on and on, forget all about things for a while, eventually come back on you. But in this, they come back right away. Like, even when I exaggerate something, there's something in me that says, you shouldn't exaggerate. You should be more careful. It's immediate now. It's not where before I had a habit of exaggerating things. Americans exaggerate things. Part of our culture. Everything's exaggerated. Just doing what an American's supposed to do. Seems perfectly normal, but then as you're aware, in a way, then even slight little white lies and gossip and all these things are the result, the resultant karma, the vibhaka karma is immediate. Because now you're completely open and vulnerable, completely sensitive. So then you are careful. Careful about what you do. It's important, you're responsible for how you live, what you do and say. It's very important to be responsible for what we do and say. And then And because of that, then we begin to feel a tremendous peacefulness in our minds. Because there's a sense of ease and fearlessness from right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, to right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. emotion, the sense of equanimity, of emotional balance, of serenity. We feel at ease within here. There's not that anxiety and that tension, emotional conflicts. There's clarity, there's peacefulness, stillness, knowing. Now this is what I would consider the perfection of our human condition. This is the opportunity we all have now. We're not just helpless victims of fate, just victims of a bad joke, just caught in a mortal trap and have no way out of it, just lost in a mysterious universe without any ability to comprehend it or know it. And that's what it seems like sometimes, like just I used to feel like a helpless victim. How did I get here anyway? What is it all about? What's the purpose of all this? Having one of these bodies and kinds of all that. Childhood, adolescence, and all that stuff. There's all so much pain involved in the whole thing. For what? Is there any point? Is there any meaning or purpose? Or is it just a cosmic accident? It's some kind of strange, weird kind of fungus that grows on the planet? Or is there something much more profound to it? I think we all sense that there's something quite wonderful about it all. Even though it's rather frightening, it's also a sense of wonder, filled with wonder. And that mental state, when your mind is filled with wonder, is what? It's not thinking anymore, is it? Wonder, kind of, your that state of wonder, when your mind is filled with this wonder, there's no thought. It's open, clear, bright. So we say, it's wonderful. I hope this will help you to develop the Eightfold Path, the Magga. I've been using this form, this Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, Dukkhas, the suffering, Samudaya, the origin, Nirodha, cessation, Magga, the path. And like the other three noble truths in Magga, there is the path, the realization of the path, right understanding. Through understanding having penetrated those first three noble truths, there's right understanding, there's samadhiti. Then the insight into that this path should be developed. And then the realization, when we have developed this path. And don't think development is something over next year. It's development of the path is now. Here and now, then this path is developed. So these are called the 12 stages. I've just given you, over these past few days, the knowledge of an arahant. What is it an arahant knows? A perfected human being. What is it an arahant knows? According to the suttas, according to the Pali Canon. He knows suffering, he knows dukkha. There he says, there is dukkha. Dukkha should be understood. Dukkha is understood. The first three. The next three are, there is the origin of suffering, samudaya. Samudaya should be laid aside. should be let go of. And then there's the realization that it has been let go of. The three kinds of desire have been let go of. Then the seventh is there is cessation, nirodha. Nirodha should be realized, and then the realization, through having practiced, nirodha is realized. There is the path, the magga. The magga, the path should be developed, the path is developed. And the 12 stages of knowledge, say, three aspects for each noble truth, the 12 stages. We chant this in the Dhammajaka Sutta. I think we'll do that before the end of this retreat. We'll invite some of the monks and nuns over and chant this remarkable sutta for you.